This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another show. Man, we are in for a treat. One of our oldest and dearest friends in the comedy world is with us for an interview today. Ladies and gentlemen, you've seen him on Reno 911. You've heard his voice probably 1,000 times through cartoons, but didn't maybe know it was him. But he is fame and fortune success out of the Laughs Unlimited. Let's welcome to the interview stage, Carlos Alazraqui.
Yes.
Carlos, it's so good to hear your voice. It's terrific to catch up. You have had an amazing career.
It has been a ride. It's been a journey. Thank you, Scott. It's good to be back inside the low ceilings club. I'm virtually in my mind of Laughs Unlimited and back on stage again in Sacramento.
So exactly. You were just saying how you had great memories of the old stage at Firehouse Alley with the low ceiling. We should let the audience know that early in both of our careers, we were able to connect. I was a young club owner, and you were an even younger stand-up comic coming out of the Northern California area. But you know what I don't know? When did you, I mean, you emceed for me. We did a lot of special projects off stage. You were one of our house regulars for years. But why don't you share with the audience what kind of got you started down that path of comedy?
Yeah, it's a man, you know, Ernie Olson, a professor at Sacramento State Recreation and Leisure Studies.
Right,
and
good friend of the club.
He just saw me as somebody that, you know, your grades are okay, but I think you're a natural born performer. So I got into his mime. We were the Leisure Time Mime Company, and we would go to schools for the deaf and special places and perform these mime sketches. We even performed them at the Good Earth, where I was working as a busboy, paying my way through college. And then my first competition after doing mime was at Harry's Bar and Grill, 4th and H Street, I want to say.
I know right where it was, yeah.
Harry's Bar and Grill, Christmas 1984. Chuck Walker won that competition. I came in third. And I think one of the prizes is where we got to do a night at your club. So I performed once there, but then I cut my teeth with Mark Fraser at Mark Fraser at the Harry's Bar and Grill, which is no longer there, on 12th and K, which is below the Club Cantel, which is where I saw Screamin' Jay Hawkins perform. But it was 12th and K, Harry's Bar and Grill, for a good solid year in a comedy duo called the Brouhaha. And I remember, because I had stage anxiety. I would go on stage by myself, but I needed a partner. And Mark just wasn't ready to go to that next level. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go MC and see if I can MC at Scott's place. And I guess I did well enough where you saw me, and I said, I'm going to be the house MC. And this is something that other MCs will tell you, and even yourself, I still get this automatic knee-jerk reaction to the Beach Boys, round, 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 I get a round. Because that meant
I was going to explain to the audience that for, 20 years, we opened every show with a Beach Boys song, and halfway through you'd hear it scratch across the record. And I'm exactly the same. I hear that song and I'm ready to jump on stage.
It was both an adrenaline thing and a nerve thing. Cause sometimes, you know how it is. Sometimes you just weren't ready to go on stage and they started that song. You're like, oh man, here we go with Railroad. And I'm going to hear that record scratch. It's like, but just being in that green room and, you know, we'll get to the people I work with and, when you think back on it, that location, that size of audience, those low ceilings, it's what a comedy club should be. And it's very hard to replicate it, you know, because comedy clubs started turning into these big airport hangars, you know, the Improv, Hit the Improv, and all these clubs. And you really grew to appreciate an intimate setting like that where you could just talk to the audience and see them all the way back in the back.
Yeah, you've struck something I've mentioned a couple times to my audience where the Firehouse Alley location, which was to me always my main club, was low ceilings. Back in the early 80s, people were still smoking. We had like a non-smoking section, but it didn't really matter. We had two levels, and even though it fit 200 people, nobody was that far away from the stage. And we always, like most clubs, we had tables right up on the stage. So it was a very intimate room, and I'm glad you have great memories of that, because I as well think that that was the epitome of what a comedy club should be, which is akin to the old jazz clubs.
Yeah. And you know what came close? The Cobbs on in the Cannery Row, Cobbs in the Cannery Row, and then the Improv when it moved to San Francisco in 1989. It was a cabaret club, and it was right on Mason and Taylor. Taylor and Gregory, and Mason and Gregory, right by the theater, right by the current theater. And it was 99 seats, low seats. And I worked with Rick Scheidner and David Spade there. But that was what that one club in San Francisco replicated, maybe the Punchline, but no, the charm of going into a brick building where you had to descend down the driveway to get into your club. It was like subterranean, right?
Oh, yeah. We were below basement level, an old brick building from like the 1840s. And it really had a lot of atmosphere. Boy, you have a great memory of it. And you're right. Yeah. It brings back warm feelings of home for me.
Yeah.
And you were, like I mentioned, house MC, start off as an MC and opening act, but obviously grew to a headliner and just terrific. Now, going back to you just getting started, this is a little test. Yeah. Do you remember your first bit or joke?
Yeah, okay. It has to be on, it must have been something like Marlon Perkins, Mutual of Omaha. You know, I'm going to take care of the Jeep. Tim is finding the Jaguar. Well, I see in the Jeep. And it was something that probably a lot of comedians had. But I remember a bit with Mark Fraser where we did, what was the great conservative, the British conservative that used to let William Buckley interviewing Floyd the Barber on foreign policy in Nicaragua.
Oh, that's one of our funny. William Buckley interviewing Floyd the Barber. That's a great setup.
Yeah, so that was one of our first solo bits. I mean, I think I did something like, this is your cat. You remember that commercial, this is your brain, this is your brain on drugs, this is your cat. This is your cat in a dryer. That was up there with one of my first bits.
Now that brings us to a really important part of the Carlos Alazraqui career. You are a very talented voice specialist. You're famous for playing the Taco Bell dog. You were Roscoe's Modern Life. You've done so many things, it'd be impossible to list them all. But how did that come about? Were you doing noise, sound effects, and voices when you were a kid? Or did you develop that as a teen and young adult?
Yeah, you know, I always go back to the origins. My parents are from South America. My dad, British educated with no accent. My mom going, Carlitos, no me digas. And then I would head over to my friend Kevin's house. He started from Glasgow, Scotland. She went to Mayhaney with Auntie. Auntie Lazen. Uncle Donnie and Carlos. And I'm hearing Carlitos, no me digas, la puta que te parió. And then I'm hearing, wait, you're using Kevin. Go out. Carlos. So it was this potpourri of dialects. And
so the dialects got you started.
I think so. And then, like every other kid, I'm watching TV and like, hey, you're looking up at the keys. Hey, Rocky. Rabbit in my head. So we were watching TV. I was watching Monty Python. And so hearing all these dialects and sounds, I just soaked it up and started spitting it out on stage. I knew that I could do voices and characters and sort of hide behind those. You know, I was always envious of a comedian that could come out as themselves and just do straight mono, like a Dennis Wolfberg or a Lois Bromfield was that.
Well, so Carlos, everybody in show business, if you're really going to succeed, you need a hook. And for some people, it's their look, like Emo Phillips. Some people, it's their attitude, like Bobby Slayton. Other people, it's pure, you know, take Seinfeld and Leno. It's their way to relate to everyday life in a funny way. But there is nothing wrong. In fact, I think it's an attribute. If you can take something like your voice characterizations and sound effects that you could do and meld it with professional creative comedy to the point where you're entertaining a bunch of strangers. I mean, you're not just cracking up your brother or sister. You're doing stuff that everybody enjoys.
Yeah, as you know, that's a big difference, right? My friends think I'm funny, but just stepping in, even out of the front row and putting your feet on stage and turning around and seeing an audience, it's a whole different ballgame. It was like skydiving. I was a skydiver for 15 years. We can get to that. I started in 95 and went through 2010. But you can watch videos of skydiving, and you can watch a video on the ground, and you go, okay, I know what's going to happen. But once you get up in that plane and that door opens and that sound is coming in the wind and you see people fall out of that plane, you're like, what the F am I doing? It's kind of that same thing.
That's an analogy I haven't heard before, but I think it's perfect because a lot of people want to think they can be a stand-up comic or want to try being a stand-up comic. And one of the biggest fears to get over is getting out on stage and talking in front of a bunch of strangers and actually being able to talk intelligently and watching it, making it look easy, and then doing it is a whole different thing, just like skydiving.
Yeah, absolutely. And my characters were my suit of armor, you know, that I could hide behind. And it took me a long time. Some comics, you know, right away, they've got it. They're in their skin. I always thought Clinton Jackson was one of those guys. Clinton was who he was early on. You know, just a good storyteller, relaxed.
Right.
And I thought, I got to be funny every second. I can't let any gaps happen. But I was good at it. I could entertain people and I could get up and I had confidence. But,
you know, you were really good. But a great example of what you just said would be Larry Miller. These days, the audience has no patience. They want a punchline like every 15 seconds. But one of the geniuses of Larry Miller was, and if you haven't ever seen him live on stage, look him up on Google. And
on the Google.
He would do a 20-minute story, and yet you were laughing all through it. And he was not in any hurry. He was just like reading a book. He was telling a story, but you were riveted and it was funny. And yet, you know, like you said, there's other people that it's like joke, you know, Stephen Wright, there was no energy, but it was joke.
Yeah.
And I still think that you being able to put the two together now, you were all around the Laughs Unlimited. I want to talk about that in a minute, but even before that or around the same time, weren't you also in the San Francisco comedy competition?
I didn't move to San Francisco to 87. So I cut my teeth for a couple of years at Laughs Unlimited. And then I moved with John Boyle. We moved to 38 Carrillo in an illegal garage converted one bedroom that was moldy as all get out with a Russian landlord named Boris who showed up in Drag Quest. Guys, when? What's happening? Literally. And I worked at two different health clubs. I worked at the Telegraph Hill Club, no longer there, the old sound stages for Streets of San Francisco. And I worked at Coal Valley Fitness teaching Nautilus, right on Coal and Parnassus. And I would do comedy at night. And then I entered in 1989 was my first San Francisco comedy competition. I think I came in like 30th place or something like that. And then in 1993, I entered again. And I think Don McMillan or Johnny Steele had just won. And I ended up winning. And I beat out Patton Oswalt and Mark Maron.
Oh, and funny.
Some years later, I would go on the WTF podcast with Mark Maron. And he wanted to talk about that, man. How did you feel about that? Because I think Mark still felt slighted. And I said, listen, I always thought you and Patton were better comics. I was just a better performer.
Well, you know, that's a good way to put it. There's a difference between a performer and a writer. But the reason I brought it up is that being one of the winners of the San Francisco comedy competition is certainly a feather in your cap, especially in your young career. But you, as you said, were already emceeing and performing at Laughs. And I don't remember, because I'm getting old myself, if you did the Great Northern California comedy competition. But
I don't know. Wasn't it Del Van Dyke would always win those?
He did win one or two of those. He was one of our top local headliners. But the history we have with you at the club. Now, we were talking about Jill, my wife, was said to say hi. Yeah.
Hi, Jill.
Remembered that every Sunday I would go work one of the other rooms that I had. I had three clubs at the time. And that she would refuse to MC. And so you were her house MC, she said, for almost a year. And she just always appreciated what you professionalism in comedy and how easy you were to work with.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a work ethic. I you know, I learned it from some of the other comics. My buddy Steve Bruner, who now lives in Santa Rosa, he really kind of instilled in me that work ethic of like, you got to get up as much as you can. You got to show up. You got to MC, and you got to, you know, practice and be professional. And so, yeah, I was an athlete, and I approached it like that. If I want to get better, I got to show up on time, because I had a paper on. I was a dishwasher. I was a busboy. So I was used to showing up for work, you know, put your helmet on, get your lunchbox, and go to work. Because sometimes it was working. It's Sunday night. You're tired. But, you know, there's a show. The audience needs to be warmed up, entertained, and, you know, get the feature act ready to go, and that's your job.
Well, you had a good mentor there. Steve Bruner, not only a good friend of mine and to this podcast, but obviously of you, has one of the strongest work ethics, clean, funny comic that is successful today as a stand-up. And you and I have been around for almost 40 years in this business, and to be able to pick on somebody like Steve Bruner and go, yeah, and he's still outperforming, you know, just like you, you're still working the craft. This many years later, you have to be a pro to be able to do that.
Oh yeah. It's what keeps you going, you know? And, I did a show the other night that I don't do as much, stand up as I used to. And my friend of mine, Jamie Taylor, was doing a virtual show through Flappers, and I forgot that I was going to move my mom. So I flew down there on a Tuesday night, on a Wednesday night, in my brother's backyard with a laptop. I did my virtual show, and I was there for it. I did my 10 minutes. I was in a coat and a beanie, and I just ripped. I just went off, and because everybody else had their virtual background, but that work ethic was there. It's like, you know what? I said I'd do the show, so I'm going to do the show. I'm going to show up.
Well, that's great. And, you know, one of the things I tried to teach a lot of young comics back in those days was that even though we're in the quote unquote entertainment business, it is a job, and you have a responsibility not only to the audience and to yourself, but you're working for a club owner or a producer, and they're counting on you. And so the fact that you respected that, from my heart, thank you, because that is not something everybody had.
Yeah, thank you. And plus, listen, I'm going to say that you were an intimidating, what's the word I'm looking for?
Asshole. Right?
No, but it, you know, because you had clubs and, but you weren't as intimidating as Steve Sharippa at the Riviera Improv. Seven nights a week shows, three shows a night. And Sharippa's like, Carlo, you do your freaking time. I don't know if we can cut, but you do your freaking time. You get to freak off the stage, all right? Do your time, bring an act up, maybe do 1 or 2 minutes, no more. And then you get off and you bring the other act up. No time in between that one. And you get off and that's it. That's the show. And so having cut my teeth at Laughs Unlimited of emceeing all those shows, I was ready for a guy like Steve Sharippa and the Improv at the Riviera and doing three shows a night, 7 nights a week, and being able to remember names and intros without writing it down. What would you like me to say?
Oh, that's
cool. I've been on Johnny Carson. My next tour date is coming up. Got it. I've done this.
Right.
That professionalism and that repetition and that approaching it like a job, he kept getting me more jobs, you know, because and that goes a long way. You can be, as you know, because you're a club owner, you could be as funny as hell, but if you're a prick, nobody wants to work with you. Or if you're messing around with the staff or whatever, like, nope, don't want to work with you, buddy. You're really funny, but too much of a headache.
I've told the story a couple of times about how one of the only acts I ever fired was Bill Maher. And nobody can say Bill Barnes not funny. He's a funny man. He's smart. He's intelligent. But, man, he was a jerk to work with, and he was disrespectful to the audiences. And that just wasn't the way I ran. But there's people out there there's other acts that were prima donnas, and then you would kind of let them be jerks just because – they may have felt like they earned it, and it wasn't, you know, I had to deal with it. My audience didn't have to deal with it. I was all about the audience. If the audience was being respected and entertained, I could put up with a little BS, but And I'm sorry you found me intimidating, but at the same time, it's probably a good thing.
It is a good thing. You just got to be a little Machiavellian, you know? You got to have a little bit of fear. And
well, let's be honest. I could be a jerk, but that was, you know, I was young. I mean, I started the club when I was 24, and I had, you know, 125 employees I was trying to corral and three clubs, a lot going on. Now, we were talking about how great you were as an MC and as a comic, and you were able to use your dialects and voices and sound effects to entertain. But we had a lot of fun offstage. I wanted to share with the podcast audience that you were also the voiceover for a lot of the Tony King commercials.
Tony King. Yeah.
And that was...
And I know it was a character that Bob Stobener played, right?
Yeah, Bob Stobener would be the he was selling records, or we did a tour of his mansion, and you did the voice of the rich and the famous guy.
That's right. My soul's a little rich and famous. Tony King. Yeah. What was that guy's name? Robin Leach.
Robin Leach.
My soul's a rich and famous. Tony King. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, Lynn Stobner, I just sent photos to his nephew. He happened to be working on the Casa Grandes, which is a Nickelodeon show I was working on. But yeah, so it was Stobner. It was Lynn Stobner, Bob Stobner. And yeah, he would do these wacky commercials. And I guess he...
We took advantage of your expertise and your dialects. We were doing what we called home videos, and we showed them on our TV show. And you helped us with the voiceover to make it sound that much more professional. So from Bob and I, thank you. It was a lot of fun. But I think you also went to a couple of the bowling nights, and we played softball a couple times. I mean, it was a it was a fun time.
Yeah, it was a very formative time in my upbringing, too, because I graduated high school in 82 years of junior college, being a jock, playing soccer and running track at DVC, and then 4 years college at Sac State, playing track, running track, and doing recreation administration, and then I become this comic, and I'm working at the Good Earth restaurant. I remember when I would invite people from the Good Earth to come see me, and staying at the comedy condos, and... You know, it was very formative. I really kind of grew up a lot there.
Well, you turned that opportunity of stage time and mutual respect. We respected your talent and helped you become a better comic. And you respected the stage and treated not only my staff and I with respect, but you were always there for the audience. And I think that combination was beneficial for everybody involved. Let's move on. So we had some really successful times together, but you did move on. I know we were talking about cartoon voices. You were the voice of, on Rocco's Modern Life.
Yeah. And I got that. Here's how I got that. I'm on the road. I did a pilot. There was a audition for Joe Murray, San Jose Mercury, cartoonist, has a project called Rocco's Modern Life. I didn't have an agent. I was in at your club in Sacramento, and I made a voice tape with a push and record at the same time cassette recorder, sent it in to a guy named Mark McNamara, who was a teacher out of San Francisco producing this thing. I showed up at Sutro Towers at this house. George Maestri lived right underneath Sutro Towers. I went in his garage in his basement, and I auditioned, and I didn't have an agent. And the story, as I've told many times, is I got spunky right away, and I was like, crazy dog. So great. Nick Jennings leaps up the chair and says, "You're spunky." And I didn't know what to do. We were trying Bruno Kirby, you know, no Pablo Iglesias. They were trying Woody Allen. They didn't want Australian. And I suddenly did Gene Wilder just to make them laugh. "You're not evil. You are good. Head again." And they started cracking up. "We love the Gene Wilder." And then I just thought, can we try an Australian thing? And I got a vacuum manual, and I just read, like, "When you're plugging in the unit, make sure that the unit is not attached to anything else. You might be electrocuted." And you're like, hey, that sounds kind of cool. They sent it to Nickelodeon. We do the pilot. I take off on the road. I'm at the last lap in Seattle. And I go to a payphone. I get a call. I think I had a pager. And they said, "Rocco's Modern Life is going to go to series." And I was like, yes!
Oh, that's awesome. Now, was that your first professional voiceover gig, or had you already done the Taco Bell dog?
No, that was Rocco's first. Rocco was first five years.
That's amazing.
So for me, I didn't love the road. I did the road, but I didn't love it. It wasn't in my heart.
Oh, it's a hard job.
It's hard. So I knew that this was an opportunity to move to LA, get off the road. And then at the same time, I had won right after I won the San Francisco comedy competition. So, so I had Rocket's Modern Life. I had 10,000 in cash. I had managers calling me. I said, it's time to move to LA. So in January 94, I Beverly Hillbillied it over to LA, got the car, got my Toyota Corolla, and found a little loft apartment where I ran into Sean Corvell. And we would sooner live together for 12 years in my house in the Valley.
Wow.
So I moved to LA and I had Rocco going, and I would do stand up. I would go on the road still and work the improv circuit. Occasionally come back and work Laughs Unlimited. And then I got Cat Dog. And then I was going back on the road. And then in 96, there was an audition for the Taco Bell Chihuahua, and I was right voice, right place, right time. You can Taco Bell, viva gorditas. And I got one commercial that turned into a whole freaking campaign. I was on Hollywood.
Man, there's
Squares,
some good money in that too. You got a Hollywood Squares?
I was right underneath Whoopi Goldberg, and I met and talked to. At that time, I was 44 years old, or 41, 1996. Let me add the ages up. 34. Taco Bell Dog, 97. I was born in 62, so that would have made me 35. Right? Yeah, 35. And I remember meeting Sugar Ray Leonard, and we're talking together. He's like, hey, man, you married? I go, no. You got kids? I go, no. I have to pull that off, man. I was like, holy crap, I'm talking to Sugar Ray Leonard. It was amazing.
Well, I got to say, if you were on Hollywood Squares, what a great way to meet some of the old stars, because they always filled the squares with the old celebrities.
Yeah. It was, it might have been Henry Winkler. I know it was Sugar Ray Leonard and definitely Whoopi Goldberg and some other. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't Elsie Summers or Paul Lynn. Those guys were long gone.
So we were talking about Hollywood Squares, and you were doing Rocco's Modern Life. You'd gotten the Taco Bell Chihuahua Dog commercials, which are all very lucrative. How did you end up getting into television? Because, ladies and gentlemen, he is one of the stars of Reno 911, that has had kind of a rebirth. It got a cult following, and didn't they done some stuff even recently with that?
Yeah. So what happened was, I got Taco Bell Dogs, and the Taco Bell Dog ended. So I started doing, actually in 95, I worked on the Stephanie Miller Show on UPN at the Soul Train stages on Paramount. For 13 weeks, I had a card on the Windsor Gate, so I could go and drive on the gate at Paramount Studios. I had a little room there. UPN was the channel. It was a late night talk show. I did sketches with James Stevens III and Karen Maruyama.
Oh, I remember James Stevens. Yeah,
very talented guy. We did tons of sketches, and we got paid little money by Buena Vista Television. That ended. Then I got the Taco Bell Dog. That ended. And I was doing radio at KBC for the Stephanie Miller Show. And then this audition for Ben, Tom, and Kerry came along in 2000 for a sketch show. I did three characters. The Shammy. I remember doing the Shammy character at Laughs Unlimited. Michael. The Shammy is an incredible thing. It was a knockoff on those late night guys. And the Shammy was a napkin that was stronger than a California marriage, Michael. So I did these characters. I got the show. We did a table read for Gail Berman at Fox. They didn't like the sketch show idea. Ben, Tom, and Kerry said, we're going to make fun of cops. Go home and think of a character. We thought of our characters. They asked us 20 questions. Beth McCarthy showed up. From SNL, she was the director of the original pilot, which did not start with Wendy McClendon Covey, who's on the Goldberg. So we shot the pilot in San Pedro in 2000. Comedy Central did not pick it up. It laid there, and a year later, Comedy Central said, we want to reshoot this. And then we went to series in 2002 or 2003, and that's how I became James Osvaldo Garcia for Reno 911. I was on for 5 seasons in a movie. Wendy, Mary, and I were left out of the 6th season. So that run ended. And then years later, I did live stuff with them. And then when Quibi came back, they brought Wendy and Mary and I back for Quibi, which is now defunct. We shot 1 full season for Quibi. We started shooting another one in October. And Quibi folded. That material exists. It hopefully will find a home on HBO Max or Comedy Central. Because if you want to see Reno 911, you can see it on Roku, on Peacock, on HBO Max,
and
on Paramount Plus.
like I said, it's got a cult following and did really well. What made that character unique? What do you think made you the right person for that particular character? Were you having fun with it?
I was. It was kind of based upon my experiences in Hollywood of really having to put up with, oh, he's in his car, let's send him out for Latino roles. I'm like, no, I'm done. What they want is, I'm not, they're looking for somebody that's darker complexion, maybe more Mexicano, because I'm a white kid with a South American lineage, you know, who are with Italian, French, and Jewish blood in me. So, and Turkish blood. So I wasn't fitting that. Outside of voiceover, I wasn't fitting into the role of these Latinos that they wanted. So I said,
yeah, they always like to typecast.
Yeah, if I get a character, I want to name him. Actually, his name was based on my roommate, Dan Garcia, who his parents were farm workers. Dan is Mexican American, married an Irish wife, listened to country music. And Dan would be like, oh, doggone, Carlos. And I went, I love that element of a guy named Dean Garcia and acting white and being self-loathing about his own heritage. Like, yeah, my name is James Olzola Garcia, but I don't act like those Mexicanos, okay? I'm all about law and justice, you know, totally racist to his own culture. And so he was uptight. He was Barney Fife. He was self-loathing and just, you know, he hated himself. And I love that about him. It was so fun to play. And I have, even though it was a comedy character, after 2 weeks of playing him when we were filming, I felt like nobody really liked me. And it was like, no, nobody likes Garcia because he's such a prick. So that's what made him work, and that's what made him so fun to play. You know, the first thing that I ever did with Friedrich Yarbrough, and I knew just from auditioning and doing a pilot, they put us in a car, turn the dash cams on, we leave, there's Usher playing on the radio, and I turn to him and my character, and I'm saying, we have to listen to this jungle music? And he was like, whoa, what? And he just went with it. And so our relationship of young, beautiful, black man, handsome black man who can get any woman with uptight racist Latino guy was born, and it worked. You know, why are these guys partners? And of course, we went on to do a sketch called Good Cop, Black Cop, which if you've seen me on 911 is where he beats me up and chokes
right,
me.
Right.
Because I equate bad cop with black cop, and he's like, it's not the same thing. And I'm like, it's the same thing. It's all semantics. Black cop, bad cop, same thing. He's like, no, it's not. And so,
I just think it's interesting because when you started acting, to be honest, I was surprised because even though you had all these dialects and voices, you really, your talents lend yourself to cartoons and commercials and in stage work. And it was interesting because, I mean, we knew each other a lot for years, but this is 10 years later. I never thought of you as an actor, you know, like when Larry Miller worked for me, he was already using, you know, makeup on stage. I mean, he came from acting, you know, some comics came from acting. Some people go to acting. And I just thought it was fascinating that you were able to turn that corner and add it.
Yeah. I think it was the advice from Larry Miller and Dave Coulier and a couple others that said, if you want your stand-up to lead to stand-up comedy and sitcoms, you got to take acting. And so I studied with the late, great Cliff Osmond, even into my L.A. years. And Cliff Osmond passed away. He was in the Fortune Cookie. He was a, you know, what's the guy who did Fortune Cookie and Some Like It Hot? Oh, I forget his name. Oliver, no. Oh, gosh, I get him mixed up with the old classic guy. But Oliver Wilde or whatever he did.
But a really good guy who knew how to act.
He was a great teacher. And so when I played Garcia, I said, I'm not going to play on top of the comedy. This guy is already ludicrous, so take him seriously. So, like, if, you know, Jones, if we're Jones and I, who's a black police officer, come across Chris Salmon playing a Klansman, and they're trying to light a cross on a lawn, and I've got my black partner with me, I'm really pissed off, and so I'm going to play it dramatically. No, you're not going to light that cross. No, stop it. Now, my partner here is getting really upset. So that's what the acting class taught me is, like, don't play on top of the comedy.
Right.
Play Garcia seriously, and then the comedy will reveal itself.
Oh, that's interesting.
Had I not taken the advice or watched people like Larry Miller on stage, because he's so great at storytelling, you know, I wouldn't have learned those things. And so,
well, I
watch Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't know you'd taken acting lessons, but it makes perfect sense because once you did get on the screen, you were a natural. And I thought it was interesting that you were able to, I've already said it, so I don't want to keep blowing up your head over it, but you know, you're able to do stand-up comedy. You're able to do voices and characters for cartoons, which is a huge career in itself. And now you find yourself as a successful actor on a series that lasts 5 years, which is more than most. So, I mean, you really were able to hit the trifecta, Carlos.
Yeah.
And it's all based on your success. That's amazing. We touched on it pre-show. You actually mentioned it. But my godson is an animator and draws for Casa Grande, a very funny cartoon. And I thought it was amazing that you did some voices on that cartoon, and he's drawing the cartoon. What a connection. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and as I said, I didn't get to send him anything from that, but I sent him Crocker and Rocco, and I sent him something from as Garcia. But yeah, I play Carlos Casagrande. He's kind of a nerd. I play Frank Sergio, the parent, and a guy named Vito Filippone, who's kind of like this Italian guy that hangs out in the Mercado, and he's kind of a mooch. And so, yeah, I'm a regular on that. That's doing really well on Nickelodeon. And it's what a small world that I would work with somebody directly related to you. You know, it all comes full circle.
Well, yeah.
And it's so sweet.
Especially since it was you, me, and Bob Stobener, his father, that were doing those old Tony King commercials where you were the kid. You were the young guy that we were taking advantage of your talent. And now, you know, 30 years later, you're doing the voiceover for his son, is that he's doing animation on, which is a unique art form in itself. It's just been amazing. Well, Carlos, what tell us what's coming up for you. What are you working on?
Well, I know this will drop a little bit later, but on March 30th, my movie that I wrote with Jill Michelle Millian and financed with my wife and produced called Witness Infection. You can always go to witnessinfection.com. It drops on Freeform Digital Media, which is Byron Allen's company. So it'll drop on iTunes, Walmart, Amazon, DirecTV, many other formats.
Okay, let's make sure it's clear. This is a movie that you did, and it's called Witness Infection.
Witness Infection, yes. And the log line is a mob boss's son is trying desperately to get out of an arranged marriage. Luckily, his friends in the zombie apocalypse are there to bail him out.
Well, that sounds like there might be some comedy in there.
Yeah. And of course, I'm working on the Casa Grandes for Nickelodeon. I work on Victor and Valentino. I play Nito. and a couple other characters. That's on Cartoon Network. Working on a show that'll come out soon called Farzar next year. Maya and the Three with the amazing Jorge Gutierrez. I was in the movie Book of Life. I played General Posada.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And I played the pig. I'm doing some more Family Guy roles, utility roles. Well, I work. I'm doing mostly voiceover stuff. And hopefully I will. We did have an announcement that Paramount Plus is going to make a Reno 911 movie. So when more details come out of that, I'll pass along to you. But for now, that has been announced in the trades. We just don't have a contract yet. So looking forward to that. And hopefully you can always watch me on HBO Max, Peacock, Paramount Plus Network. All the old episodes of Reno are on there.
Well, and I just have to tell you, Carlos, it was not only an amazing time to share our life on stage back in the early 80s and mid 80s and into the 90s, but to watch and see how your career has blossomed, taking your immense talent and voice talents to levels that only other people can dream about. So congratulations. I know that none of it came easy. You always worked hard. You always were a professional. But to share time with us on this podcast and let my audience in on some of the stuff you've done is really incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a comedy set from Carlos taped live at my club from back in the 80s coming up right after this interview so you can hear some of Carlos on stage. But right now we're going to sign off. Carlos, thanks for doing this. Everybody be listening for his character on Rocco's Modern Life and Casa Grande, and keep an eye out for the Reno 911 movie, and also look up and watch his shows. Carlos, thanks so much for doing this.
You're welcome, Scott. And might I add that I'm on Stephanie Miller every Wednesday. You can hear me doing my Dr. Fauci. And
you do sound just like Fauci.
I want you to stay safe. Make sure that you're inoculated when you can. Keep your distance. Wear a mask. And stay healthy. So,
all right, Carlos. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, Carlos Alazraqui. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Scott. You're welcome.
Welcome to another week at Laughs. We got a great show coming up for you. Right now, it's one of a big round of applause. We have some great comedy coming from a comic impressionist from right here in Sacramento. I think you'll enjoy them. You guys are ready, right? Yeah. Big round of applause, Carlos Alazraqui.
Last year, the Pointer Sisters. I'm so excited. Went all the way to number one. This year, it's climbing the charts again. Thanks to that crazy old man from the David Letterman show. Here he is to sing. I'm so excited. Mr. Larry Bud Melman.
I'm so excited. And I just can't hide it. I am about to lose control. And I think I like it.
Larry Bud Melman there for you, ladies and gentlemen. All right, yeah. All right, all right. I was kind of a rowdy kid when I was young. Man. Me and my brother, we got way out. We did some crazy things. Like, my mom would come in, we'd be fooling around. You kids cut out that horseplay. Ow, Mom, Timmy's nailing metal shoes to my feet. Ow, ow. Yeah. Yeah, we were rowdy, man. We were never guys, me and my brother, that got stoned on the weekends, you know. And they made excuses for their lack of behavior. Like, you ask them to do things, it's like, hey, Fred, let's go to the park. Is it free? No way. No, we were always like the Asian culture, because I admired the Asian culture, because they're so full of life, you know. Everything they do is a la martial arts, from tennis to shopping. Ooh, it's a big store, Bakansi! Oh, look at all the Bakansi here today. It's a red taxi. They get into it. It's great, huh? It's like they play a simple game of ping pong. It's 25-25. We play a tiebreaker too. 10,000. Good shot, winner. Let's go to Bakansi. Yeah. Okay. I think that's great, you know, because you get Fred and Stu playing the same game on a Friday night. It's like, play some Pong, dude? Is it free? Sure, serve it up, dude. Dude, right in the eye, man. Sammy Davis Jr. Ball underneath the table. Can you get it? What? No, man, I can't get it. How about you? Dude, I can't even scope it, man. So what? Game's over. I like doing that bit. Kind of gets the saliva going. I feel like Carol Channing. She did. She had that saliva problem when she started out, and went on through it with the years. You know, she actually had a roadie travel with her, a dental assistant on the road, and kind of helped her out during the songs. It was kind of like, "Gang, gang, 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 gang." Kind of fun to watch. Happy to be here at last. I'm limited tonight because I'm a horrible driver. I always get lost. Well, it's not entirely my fault. I went to the doctor's the other day, and he told me I had that learning disability where you read things backwards, dyslexia. And yeah, I just found out tomorrow. And so naturally, I'm on my way over here Tuesday to make it. And I got lost in L.A. I turn a corner. I see Ricardo Montalban in a white tux selling flowers. So I pull up to honk the horn. I go, excuse me, Mr. Montalban, I'm lost. I'm from SF. Can you help me back? Good day, stranger. Welcome to Los Angeles, California. Nice level. If you wish to go back to San Francisco, you must first take a left turn at the next light. And the road will take you straight to I-5 North. However, I must warn you that if you decide to take I-5 tonight, that you will be subject to the strange hypnotic powers of one of California's most boring highways. Idiot. Now, not only am I lost, I'm afraid to go home. So I whip into this 7-Eleven. There's these surfer punks out in front. Hey, you kids, can you help me out? Give me some directions. Is it free? These guys are everywhere. So I say, forget it. I'm pissed off. I'll just find a hotel. I'll start again in the morning. So I whip around the corner and I go, great! Because down at the end of the road, I see this taxi cab driver pull up to him, honk the horn. Listen, buddy, you're my desperation. You gotta help me out, please.
Boy, are you pretty lucky you found me. Because I happen to know L.A. like the back of my hand. It was there yesterday. All right, you wanna go? You wanna go? You wouldn't happen to know where we are right now, would you?
Thanks very much. You have fun with the rest of the show.
Carlos Allen's Rocky!
Ladies and gentlemen, Carlos Allen's Rocky, one of the best in the business, got his start at Laughs Unlimited back in the early 80s and has gone on to fame and fortune. Hey, keep an eye out for the remake of the movie Reno 911 and get a chance to watch the old shows online. Very, very funny. Oh, and if you get a chance, my godson is an animator on Casa Grande and Carlos does voices on that cartoon. Check it out. We hope you enjoyed this special interview of Carlos Allen's Rocky. Thanks for listening, and don't forget, next week, another great show. Bye!
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.